In South America's embrace, I firmly stand. From Brazil's shores to Argentina's sway, my members together pave the way. Economic union, a regional dream. What am I? And that was this week's e-International Relations Riddle Challenge. Stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear the solution to this week's riddle. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Thinking Global podcast by e-International Relations, the world's leading open access website for students and scholars of international relations. My name is Kieran O'Meara, and as ever, I am your host, and this week you have joined us for part two of my interview with Professor Eikenbury on liberal international order. Before we crack straight on with that, don't forget to click on that little follow or subscribe button. That way you'll be able to get all the content that Thinking Global has to offer directly to your device the moment that it's uploaded. And also don't forget to check out e-International Relations on social media, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Twitter, X formerly Twitter, TikTok and Instagram. There you'll just be able to find loads of more content that isn't necessarily on the website at e-ir.info. And do go and check out e-International Relations. There's just loads of free books. Yes, you heard me right, free books, articles, interviews, reports, so on and so forth. Go check it out. It really is amazing. Okay, today I am in conversation with Professor Eikenbury for our second part of our two-part series on liberal international order. We are also going to find the solution to that riddle at the very end of this episode. And alongside that, in the intermission, I am going to read out the winning letter from this week's open letter competition. So stay tuned. Professor G. John Eikenbury is the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Politics and International Affairs at Princeton University in the Department of Politics and the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. He is also co-director of Princeton's Center for International Security Studies. Professor Eikenbury has authored 8 books and a number of articles. His books include most recently A World Safe for Democracy, Liberal Internationalism and the Crises of Global Order, and Liberal Leviathan, The Origins, Crisis and Transformation of the American System. He also wrote After Victory, Institutions, Strategic Restraint and the Rebuilding of Order After Major Wars, alongside Liberal Order and Imperial Ambition, American Power and International Order. He has also recently authored a journal article in International Affairs entitled Three Worlds, the West, East and South, and the Competition to Shape Global Order. We're going to be talking a little bit about that throughout the interview. Okay, part two. Let's roll. Okay, so this is where the second part of this interview will begin, Professor Eikenbury. So, how would you respond to the charge by figures such as Professor Mearsheimer that liberal international order, liberal hegemony, liberal international organizations like NATO are actually the chief cause of the Russo-Ukrainian war?
Well, that's a more complicated discussion than simply who's to blame, because there's a lot of blame that has to be shared and a lot of layers and temporal unfoldings that are important in sorting out cause and effect and therefore blame. I do think that there were missed opportunities to engage Russia in the 1990s. I was not a advocate of NATO expansion, but it was in many ways part of the post-Cold War effort to create a space for countries that had been let loose by the end of bipolarity and the collapse of the Iron Curtain, countries wanting security, and NATO was in part expanded to not just guard against future encroachments by a revisionist Russia. Some worried about that, but as much the worry was, how do we get framework of security for countries that could create trouble across the Eurasian landmass? And so NATO created more security than it created insecurity for many many years and decades, reinforcing civil-military relations in countries that had not built that kind of constitutional framework, reinforcing the European Union project. But as I said, what was missing, and one of the first, let me just say there are three, let me identify three missed opportunities. One would be whatever the fate of NATO expansion, it wasn't matched with equal measures to engage and bring Russia into a common security system. And there were efforts at that, but it failed for a lot of different reasons. But that was part of the problem. The movement of NATO eastward was not matched with a kind of superstructure of greater cooperation and security coordination between Russia and the West. I was at the State Department at the end of the Cold War in 1991-92, and it was really odd to be there at policy planning. And our task in the winter of 1991-92, after the coup in Moscow, that when Gorbachev was on holiday and the young charismatic politician Boris Yeltsin got on a tank, CNN raised his fist in the air, the democratic forces in Russia were rallied, the coup was put down, but the Federation collapsed and the Cold War was over. And there we were at policy planning, more generally around Western capitals, trying to figure out how can we keep Russian democracy from snuffing out? How can we keep the baby in the crib from dying? So we were coordinating aid, food, energy, housing for Soviet troops, Soviet / Russian troops returning from the east. So there was a kind of, in great power context, a kind of anomalous strategy of trying to build up the country that had just suffered its worst defeat, and to keep the momentum of reform democracy alive. There was a failure of that, and I think if not keeping and building a framework, a security framework with Russia, the other failure, I guess you'd have to say, was the famous export of neoliberalism to Russia. The kind of the Soviet state was carved up, and huge parts of state assets were given off to oligarchs, and the people were the losers in this whole effort of shock therapy. And there was an irony in this, in that the great successes of post-war reconstruction and reintegration into a common security space, Germany and Japan after World War II, it was a New Deal type of reconstruction, not a neoliberal one. And indeed, the United States was exporting ideas that it itself had not fully or even substantially embraced. So we didn't give good advice to the Soviet / Russians. And then thirdly, the West has been a kind of haven for illicit assets, corrupt assets, hot money from the East, and the banks and the various places in which that wealth has been stripped out of Russia and put into Western financial hands has made the West complicitous in this Putinism that has just boiled down to its toxic core. But would NATO, if NATO had not been expanded, would Putin have put on a different face and acted differently? I don't think so. I think he's playing a much more world historical game than NATO expansion is threatening me, so I'm going to respond in a kind of reciprocal way. It's not about competitive security. It's more about competitive visions of the future. Even if it were about NATO expansion, there were 100 things that Putin could do to improve his security position in the wake of that. And he chose 1, 7, and 29, so to speak. He chose certain options, but there were other options as well. So it's not simply if you do X, then what Putin is doing in Ukraine is the obvious and inevitable outcome. Quite the contrary. There's a jagged pathway that goes both directions, and Putin should not be released from blame for the war crimes and the sheer inhumanity of his military aggression. So I think it would be a mistake to trace all the blame to Western moves in earlier decades.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about your time in the State Department, but I fear that that would be a whole other podcast episode. So what I'd like to talk about now is something in relation to what you mentioned about the Global South, and can focus a little bit more on the Global South. In your recent article for International Affairs, you state that, quote, "The Global South's critique of the Global West, generally speaking, is not that it offers the wrong pathway to modernity, but that it has neither lived up to its principles nor shared sufficiently the material fruits of liberal modernity," end quote. Would you be able to unpack that notion for us?
Yes, this is something I'm very interested in, and there are many, many really interesting scholars out there who are working on this, Matthias Spector, many others who are attempting to give us a sense of what the gravamen is coming out of the Global South at this particular moment relating to these issues, to the contest between Russia and the West, and more generally, the liberal international order and its travails today. My argument is that, unlike China, the critique of, we'll call it, liberal modernity is not a systematic or systemic critique. It's not a critique where we reject your basic assumptions and therefore we are occupying a different intellectual space. Even China may not be doing that, but it's doing more of that than what I think, broadly speaking, are the rich varieties of ideas coming out of the Global South. I'm in awe of the Global South intellectually and politically. There are so many thinkers and movements and ways of talking about the world that have come out of these countries that have stepped up and provided leadership in the name of a broader coalition of states that we call the Global South. But it's not, as I see it, a kind of, broadly speaking again, because you can find all different kinds of ideas. So you can always find contrary positions. But broadly speaking, it is not a set of global arguments that are suggesting a revolution away from modern liberal modernity. For example, the new international economic order of the 1970s had much more of a sense of a kind of movement towards a fundamentally different kind of system that would ultimately modify or in various ways overturn liberal capitalism, open world economy, movement of trade and finance. So this seems to be much more of a reform system. And when I say that, the critique seems to be that Western liberalism and liberal internationalism has speaks in a lofty way about mutual gains and openness and raising all boats, the kind of inclusive, open system that is capable of incorporating new members. All of this has been part of the system, and I think that has been appreciated, I think, and not opposed by the Global South, but rather the critique has been, you haven't done enough of it. You want liberal internationalism? Well, give us more of it, not less of it. Don't cut it off. Don't cut it off at agricultural trade, for example, or various ways, immigration or finance and investment. for development. So we want more, not less. And then secondly, and relatedly, that we are not opposed to this broad vision of liberal modernity, but we think the fruits of it should be more widely distributed. So these are our arguments about about development, about the search for status of states, about social justice, measured in terms of liberal principles, equality and liberty and respect and reciprocity. So in some sense, the critique of the West by the global South is taking place using principles forged in the global West. And that's what I have in mind, that is not a universe apart. It's about sharing authority, not overturning basic principles. And while I want to encourage us to continue this debate, and indeed at Princeton in the spring, we are holding at my Reimagining World Order program a big conference on precisely this question. What are the ideas coming out of the global South about reform and transformation of the global system, world making, to coin the term of the day? And I think it is an open debate, but my operating arguments going into this ongoing debate are the ones that I've just suggested.
Hello and welcome to the intermission for this week's Thinking Global podcast episode. Now, if you're a frequent listener, you know that this is my favourite time of the week because I get to read out some of your letters. Now, this week we had an open letter competition. We asked for you to send in your letters to answer the question, what is the most necessary shift in policy or collective approach required to address climate change and why? So this week, our favourite letter came from Hugues Leplante-Clement. Now, Hugues is a graduating student in international relations and international law at UQAM in Montreal, in Canada. He explores discrimination in an intersectional perspective and the UN's policies towards a more inclusive approach in international law. Well, Hugues, we have to say, your letter answering this question was just brilliant. So he has titled this, Towards Environmental Justice, Granting Legal Personality to Ecosystems. Recent resolutions from the Human Rights Council in 2021 and the General Assembly in 2022 elevates a safe, clean, healthy, and sustainable environment to the status of fundamental rights. Despite the evident progress of this approach, it remains anthropocentric, suggesting a precedence given to humans within the ecosystems of which they themselves are a part. Christopher Stone's 1972 article still resonates today. Granting legal personality to a tree may seem utopian or even ridiculous, even though corporations enjoy such prerogatives. In reality, anti-speciesism does indeed serve as a legal foundation in non-Western cultures. India has granted dolphins the status of non-human persons since 2013, while Argentina granted fundamental rights to Cecilia, a chimpanzee, in 2016. Furthermore, some states explicitly grant rights to nature, such as Bolivia with its Mother Earth Rights Law in 2010, Ecuador protecting nature's rights in its constitution in 2008, or the legal personality granted to the Whanganui River in New Zealand in 2017. Moreover, the 2001 Magna Sumo Awastingin versus Nicaragua case proves eloquent, as the Inter-American Court of Human Rights respects indigenous philosophy, which considers the territory as a natural element and a global public good. The private property right of land does not exist. The very concept of a healthy environment as a subjective right exposes itself as contradictory. The logic of polluter pays persists. Granting legal personality to ecosystems can generate jurisprudence, substantially protecting the environment before private anthropocentric interests, and encourage the global society to recognize the fundamental rights of the environment. Moreover, this approach recognizes the undeniable fact that the main cause of environmental deterioration lies in anthropocentric actions. Hugues, we thought your particular letter was just an absolutely brilliant answer. So thank you ever so much. Absolutely fantastic. And for all of you that did send in letters that were not read out, thank you ever so much for doing so. They were all absolutely brilliant. Stay tuned for the next open letter challenge that will be announced with next week's episode. Also, we still love hearing your letters and receiving your letters about what you've been listening to on this podcast, what you've been reading on international relations, and just what you're publishing on at the moment. We want to know all about you. So please do send us your letters to thinkingglobal.eir@gmail.com and have them read out on the podcast. Okay, let's return to Professor Eikenberry. Okay, Professor, what do you understand to be the major overarching qualities of liberal internationalism, both contemporarily and historically? Now, I do want to say that I understand that can be many, 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 many volumes of books.
Well, that is a great question that is difficult to answer in a short space. But the qualities of liberal internationalism, I think, start with the most basic insight that comes with liberal internationalism, and that is across 250 years of liberal democracy, from its infancy, from its beginning, from the age of democratic revolutions, where liberal societies were just beginning, certainly incomplete in terms of the franchise, in terms of racial equality and all the other features, but nonetheless on a pathway. From that point to today, the liberal international impulse at its core has been to create an environment, or in liberal Leviathan, I use the word milieu, or you can use the word ecosystem as I do in my most recent book, a kind of environment or ecosystem in which liberal democracies can do things together. Number one, aggregate power. There's power in numbers, solve problems of interdependence, which liberal modernity brings forth in great volume. And this is important and unique to some extent for the subgrouping in the world system of liberal democracies, managing in an ongoing way the tensions and indeed even contradictions that lie at the heart of liberal democracy. These societies have principles, regime principles, that are in some sense in tension with each other: liberty and equality, sovereignty and interdependence, individualism and community. And so in many ways, these societies need frameworks, a kind of system of relations to allow them to do the ongoing work of liberal democracy. Republican liberal states from the beginning, from Venice to Holland to Britain to the modern republics, American and around the world, are, as been noted from the very beginning, fragile systems, because they are polities that are built around attempting to limit state power. Constitutionally mandated weakness at the core to prevent tyranny and despotism that have all too often creeped into these systems. So this is a a type of polity that needs the world to be organized in a way so that those principles can survive, like orchids in a hothouse or in a greenhouse. You need an ecosystem, an environment around it. Or another way of putting it, in graduate school, we read and we continued to love the piece by Peter Gurevich, The Second Image Reversed, which was an argument about how the international order impacts domestic structures, not just the other way around. War systems can create incentives for states to centralize power and to mobilize military capacity, and that creates regime impacts. The outside world changes the shape of the inside world. What I'm suggesting liberal internationalism is doing is the second image reversed with a twist. That is to say, you are actively trying to create the international system or create features in it that will then, in a second image reversed way, create an ongoing stream of constraints and opportunities for those states to maintain what they want to be at home in terms of their regime principles and their polity. So this, I think, is the central impulse of liberal internationalism. It's tied to convictions that trade and exchange is good, properly managed, that rules and institutions can facilitate cooperation, that shared values that democracies hold can give them cooperation advantages, interests, values, and capacities to do things together. It's not an accident that they tend to work together. They find themselves on the same side of these big modernity conflicts. And then finally, another conviction at the heart of liberal internationalism, that under conditions of rising economic security and environmental interdependence, under conditions of rising interdependence, the costs of lost autonomy associated with making binding commitments to other states, particularly democracies, is less than the gains that you accrue from coordinating your policies. That's a core conviction. So openness, institutions, democratic advantage, conditions of interdependence creating incentives for multilateralism. This is, I think, at the heart of the liberal vision. It's, as I've tried to argue in my book, it's not an idealist vision. In graduate school or in college, kids learn IR, there's realism, and then there's idealism. Well, that's not what liberalism is. It's in many ways, and in the work I've done with Dan Dudney, it's deeply materialist. It's about creating responses to modernity. Liberals are realists who have been mugged by modernity, if you will. It's and therefore best seen as pragmatic, opportunistic, reform-oriented, focus as it does not on, as realists, the problems of anarchy, although liberals think the problems of anarchy are important and they have something to say about them, the problems of modernity, where we look at this modernizing world and you see Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, you see the great benefits that come from technological and economic explosive growth and transformation given science and technology, but also you see the downside. So liberal internationalism is an effort to gain the benefits of modernity and guard against its downfall. And that's what brings us to I think the bottom line for liberal internationalism, and that is that it is a kind of living set of ideas for organizing the world in the face of these great revolutionary challenges. Its value is ultimately in whether it solves problems that people care about in various parts of the world. And its future will hinge really on whether it can do what it's done in the past, which is survive these great struggles for the world and reinvent and reimagine a liberal space for a new era. And while no one can guarantee that, there certainly will be a demand for that in the world. The question, will there be a supply? I don't know.
Okay, that's definitely the one that I'm going to use for the trailer, I think. So sadly, we only have time for one more question. And that is the question that we ask everybody that comes on the podcast. And that's simply, what is it to think globally for you?
To think globally for me is to be open to the world of the past as well as the present and future. That to be a global thinker is not just a spatial imperative, to look beyond your own country, to put yourself in the shoes of others in different countries. We've talked about the global South and the global East and West, but to look back at the world in its earlier global incarnations, to remember that we're not the first ones to stumble onto these difficult problems. We're not the first ones to lose sleep at night, wondering whether our systems of diplomacy will keep the peace. We are perhaps not all that much wiser than the Greeks and the Romans or the ancient Chinese. We have in that sense a lot to learn from them. So for me, I always want to remind my students that we are never at a point where we can stop reading, stop thinking, and stop looking back for insights, because the complexity of the world, the sheer diversity of agents, ideas, and agendas makes it necessary for us to always be open and not turn our theories into dogma, to keep open systems, intellectually speaking, for further education and learning. And so to think globally today is to be a student of the world. And whether you're young or old, think of yourself as a student. And for me, that is the both the imperative, but it's also what makes it exciting to be doing what we do in this field.
And what a fantastic note to end that on. Professor Eikenbrie, thank you ever so much for coming on the Thinking Global podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so, so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be with you, Karen.
I have to say that of all the different interviews I've done, this interview with Professor Eikenbrie was just fantastic. I've read Professor Eikenbrie's work for a long time, ever since I was an undergrad. And what I love about his work is the ability to continually bring up new questions about aspects of liberal international relations theory we think, or generally we would determine ourselves to have already found answers to. Where that site is, Eikenbrie allows us to rethink that and continually probe what we consider to be liberal international order and how it functions. And that I absolutely love. So thank you again to Professor Eikenbrie for coming on. Now, before we solve this week's e-international relations riddle challenge, which I know you're all dying to hear the answer to, I would like to say that if you've enjoyed this interview and the other interviews that Thinking Global has brought to you, and all the content of e-international relations, please do remember that international relations is staffed by volunteer recruits alone. All the time that we spend editing, commissioning, and bringing the content to you is unpaid. So please, 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 if you feel that you've enjoyed the content of e-international relations, consider a donation so we can continue to bring you this content. Thank you. There will be a link in the description box if you do want to donate, and a link in the description box to e-international relations, where there's loads of free books, articles, reviews, and written interviews, which are just absolutely brilliant, I have to say. Go and check that out. now. Also, don't forget to click on that little follow or subscribe button. Please, please, please. That would mean the world to us and means you don't have to go searching for us next week. And it's a great one next week as well. We're going to begin talking about the Indian elections next week. Ooh. So that should be really, really interesting. So you don't want to miss that. So click on that little follow or subscribe button so that you'll have that sent to your phone the moment it is uploaded. Before we go anywhere, I'd like to just say a couple of thank yous. First of all, massive thanks to Angela Samford. Angela, you're a legend. Thank you ever so much. Without you, this particular episode would not have been possible. Thank you. Thank you. I'd also like to thank the E-International Relations podcast team. That is Edward Curry, Catherine Dameron, Tasharika Decker, Jennifer Engel, Nigel Huckle, Daniel McDade, Eduardo Pieroni, and Romanos Orfeus Toffis. I'd also like to welcome the newest member of our happy little band at E-International Relations, Victoria H. Bergstrom, who will be joining the Thinking Global podcast team as of now. Can't wait to start working with Victoria. You guys are all absolutely amazing, and I don't know where I would be without you. And don't forget, if you want to join the team at E-International Relations, we are always recruiting, so go to the Join Us page on the website. And music was by Material Music. Okay, I think it's time to solve this week's riddle. In South America's embrace, I firmly stand, from Brazil's shores to Argentina's sway. My members together pave the way. Economic union, a regional dream. What am I? Tough one. And the answer was Mercosur or Mercosul. Mercosur or Mercosul. Congratulations if you got that correct. And the winner of this week's shout-out is Omar Alejandro Loera. Well done, Omar. You got this one in 3 minutes flat. 3 minutes. Amazing. So, Omar is a doctor in politics and international relations from Edinburgh University and is professor investigator at the CIDE in Mexico. And their profile also says that they're a big Beatles fan, and I have to say that I am too. That's a terrible joke, and it's even worse because you can't see me shaking my head when I do that, doing my worst Ringo Starr impression. Well, thank you ever so much for taking part, Omar. You've done fantastically. 3 minutes flat. It's so quick. It's brilliant. And stay tuned, everybody else. Well done if you got it right, but stay tuned for another riddle challenge that is incoming. And next week, there will be another open letter challenge. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Don't forget to go check out the website. Click on the little like, share, subscribe, or follow button. And I guess there's nothing else really to say apart from I've been Kieran O'Meara, and together we've been Thinking Global. See you next week.